Welcome to Back Porch Chats,
where we have conversations about hope, grace, and recovery.
Our mission is to shape 12-step communities where sponsors and sponsees support each other to move beyond the shame of abuse.
We are dedicated to sharing knowledge about the connection between addiction and sexual abuse with people who are struggling to stop their destructive compulsive behavior.
Are you ready to embrace freedom from your past trauma?
And help others do the same? If so, grab a cup of coffee.
And join the conversation on the back porch with Vince
and Gina.
All right, Gina, here we are. Another podcast.
Mm-hmm. I'm very excited today.
Oh, yes. Very good. I've already been able to make connections with these people. And I have a fellow musician who was probably impressed with our opening music because the musician did all of it. That's sitting right here in this chair. Mm-hmm. Everything that was there was me. So I know she's sitting there going, wow, why is he not a member of the Eagles? Why did they pick Joe Walsh instead of Vince Harris? All right, enough of my silliness. We got some good stuff today, and I want to just jump right in it. So, Gina, first of all, how you doing?
I'm great.
So, introduce our guests so we can let them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, our guests is Josh and Holly, and we've talked with them a little bit, and I think they're right up our alley. You know, we believe that connection is the most important part of recovery. And, you know, we can't recover in a vacuum. I couldn't recover in a vacuum. I had to go to meetings. I had to have support of family. So there's no vacuum. And that's what they do is work with families in recovery. So let me give you the bio. Josh and Holly started a nonprofit. And I did not ask how to pronounce this. Josh, Holly, can you say that?
Kaizen, yeah.
Oh, I did it right. Okay. To develop training programs for teens and young adults in relationship violence prevention and crisis intervention coaching for families with at-risk loved ones. This is exactly what we're talking about with, you know, with a different age focus. Their work inspired a collaboration resulting in the book series Bang Head Here. What a great title. And I'm looking forward to hearing more about those. And actually, I was checking out their website this morning. They got some follow-up books. I think it looked like three on top of the one. I don't know. They'll correct me on that.
Yeah, they're getting some head shaking. Those in the podcast land can't hear their head shaking, but those on YouTube will.
Yeah. Well, you know, if they shake hard enough, they'll be banging their head here and following right along. All right.
You just got a smart out of me, Gene.
This is something I'm learning from Vince, those dad jokes, you know.
Yeah. Very important.
Learning too well about the dad jokes. So tell us about what you're doing.
Well, let's bring them on. We have Holly and Josh.
Great to be here.
Good deal. Glad to have you.
We're super excited to be here. I think there's a lot of correlation in what you guys are working on, what we've been working on for the last, 15, 20 years. I think we've kind of been doing a lot of this coaching and working with people who are feeling disconnected and maybe addicted or suffering through their traumas and abuses. And so it's a great conversation and a great opportunity to kind of come together here on this podcast and discuss what we feel like are the root causes, what we feel like gets in the way of connection, what we feel like are skills and steps that we can take as caretakers, as parents, as maybe people who are in the midst of a trauma or of an addiction to connect more and find healthier routes towards the lives that they want to live. And I think that's what makes Holly and I really passionate about what we're doing, is just reconnecting people.
Well, so, which brings me, why is connection so important?
In my work, in my personal journey, in my work, and there's a lot of things that I'm sure we all have in common on this podcast or have felt, you know, in our lives or maybe experienced, but I've worked with a lot of young people, young adolescents mainly, and have been able to bang my head against the wall with some of these kids for months and months and months and not understanding why is it that they're not getting any better, not wanting to get any better, that their kind of systemic addictions or just kind of ways that they're acting out is just not improving. And it's not that it took a while, but I can look back at every single experience that I had when there was a major, major turning point in somebody's story and realizing that it was some point of connection that allowed them to then have the trust to be able to hear or listen to what the reality of their situation was, the reality of the advice or the path that I was trying to create for one of those adolescents or young adults that I was working at. And so it really just comes down that people trust when they feel that there is a genuine connection and they're open to new opportunities and new ideas if they feel genuinely connected to somebody. And we tend to do it all opposite and all wrong, where we just kind of push and we get frustrated and we try to just, you know, we're just banging our heads against the wall trying to get change to happen, but realizing the key component to that is true connection.
I think also connection is kind of like one of these cornerstones of existence. I think that it makes us feel good about ourselves and about life. And when we don't feel connected to the people that we grew up developing a love for from the time of birth, then we can feel lost, and that can feel scary, and that can bring us depression and a need to be filled. So connection is so important for overall wellness.
I know that my childhood abuse made me feel isolated. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I was going as, being betrayed by the primary caregivers at an early age. Basically isolated me, and I didn't trust, you know. So what I just kind of heard what you talked about is you being a former junior high teacher, I understand that, and you spent a lot of time developing trust for that connection. So
it's not easy one, I don't think, especially when there are traumas and abuses like the ones that you're talking about, that people don't trust easy. But as Holly said, it is such a cornerstone of our lives to be able to, like, it's a basic human need. If we look at Maslow's hierarchy, I mean, if it's in there to be connected, to have that there. And so when that's not there, everything just becomes out of whack. And we look and we search for ways to feel connected, and sometimes with a substance, with the wrong people, whatever it might be, but we're constantly looking for connections.
I think that was too the part of the evolution aspect. I've read about that and talked about that in other formats. But this whole evolution, if we're not part of a tribe, you know, we die. And it's kind of built into us to be needed as part of the tribe, to be surrounded by people. And, you know, in my own experience, I know my mom would not have done anything to cause me harm. But what I came away with, based on what my life was a lack of security that I'm still searching for today. I still want financial security, home security, love security. And if I had to tell you the one thing that I'm missing, it's not even the connection, although I know how I'm missing that and how that's helped. It's the security that comes with the connection.
And that security allows you to have the, you know, the faith and the trust to connect. I think those are basic human needs that aren't, if not fulfilled, you know, connection is way far down the road. You don't have the time or the energy or even just the capacity to be able to connect, because you're wondering if there's going to be a roof over your head or if there's going to be, you know, food in your fridge. And so, yeah, there's a lot that gets in the way of connection, whether that's happening personally, in a family, in a tribe, in a culture, right? And that's what we're really all about, is breaking that down and letting people know that there are pathways to connection no matter what you're facing at that moment.
I have reached a point in my life where I felt so insecure about just telling my mom who I'm dating, what I've decided to do in work. I mean, literally, at one point I said, she will never get to know any of this stuff, because anytime I tell her, and I love my mom to death, that she's just a little bit of a negative nanny. But anytime I tell her, I come back with this negative response. So I didn't feel secure to tell her. Now I'm looking back at that as a teenager. If I'm, you know, involved in drugs, involved in violent relationships, involved in any of that stuff, and I'm not willing to tell that one core person who could help me the most, I can so see how that would create this inability to help your child through drugs and alcohol, and again, abusive relationships, or, you know, sexual trauma, or anything they might be going with.
Yeah, I think that is a very real situation that a lot of parents and families go through, that's affecting the way to communicate. Mm-hmm. I think that there are a lot of expectations that parents have, hopes. Some of it they're bringing in from their past conditioning, the way that they've been raised, maybe what they think is appropriate, they haven't even processed whether it applies, you know,
right.
And families, they're just reacting. And so we do spend a lot of time talking about that in the book, being aware, self-aware of the conversations you're having, being aware of the way that you're reacting to a loved one that's trying to, you know, be truthful and honest with you, and taking some responsibility if they start to shut down and not talk to you anymore in your role in creating an environment that felt safe for them to do that. I think that what you experienced is spot on with a lot of families, what they're dealing with.
I'm in love with stories. I love stories. I bet y'all both have a favorite story that y'all would like to tell that probably does a real good job of outlining or detailing kind of what you're talking about. Raise your hand. Teaching in me comes out. Don't make me call on
someone. No, I can go. I mean, there's a lot of faces that are flashing in my mind right now, and I do have a lot of hard won stories, especially when dealing with addiction. I just remember a kid that I was working with for a really, really long time, maybe 3 or 4 years. And it was literally one of the most frustrating experiences of my life, because I felt like I was in a place of trust with this kid. You know, he was 15, and this is, you know, maybe 3 years into it. So he's getting close to 18, and getting worse, getting on harder drugs. It went from being on, you know, just smoking pot and drinking and sneaking out at nighttime and getting bad grades, to by the time he was, you know, approaching his 18th birthday, we were dealing with heroin and harder drugs, right? It was for me, like I felt almost as a caretaker role, because he wasn't talking with his parents. He wasn't talking to anybody in his family about what was going on. I was feeling like I was the main caretaker, and I was really realizing from the, you know, my approach to it, that there was something off with me, because this kid was just not letting me know what the core root of what was going on. And I remember one day just having this aha moment where it's just like, I have to take responsibility here. There is something that I am doing right now that is not allowing this kid to just open up. So I sent him a text message that said, hey, in a few days, we're going to go play some tennis. And I just really took the 3 days to look at all my conversations with him, the different things that I was doing that was not allowing for connection to happen. And so we went and played some tennis, and I really analyzed where I was coming from. And after tennis, I apologized. And I said, I am not seeing this in the way that I think that you're seeing this. I'm not approaching this in the way that I think that you need. And I just need you to know that I own that. And immediately this kid just kind of broke down and was super, super grateful. And in that moment allowed me in enough to understand what abuse happened, at what age, and what was going on that was continuing to fuel the fire towards harder and harder drugs and deeper addiction. And there are many stories about that, but that was a very rapid one. I mean, a lot of this takes time, and I'm not trying to say that it takes one conversation and things just change as rapidly as that did. But for me, it was just a really beautiful moment of me understanding my ownership, understanding what I was doing wrong, really, really apologizing for that, and really, really expressing that I wanted to be a part of the healing path and not being a stumbling block for this kid anymore. And that just opened up a door to where now he's been sober for 6 or 7 years and is just doing really, really well. And it was just that moment for me where, like, I'm not doing something right, and just allowed for more opportunities to happen.
You know, it's been my experience as a junior high teacher that the thing that kids really crave, or students, especially in that early age, young teenage, is somebody being authentic. Somebody that's vulnerable first, authentic. It's that's such a huge invitation to authenticity from them as well. Good for you. That's good.
Yeah. It was really powerful to know that. I think that I thought that that's what I was doing, that I had to really take some time to figure out what I was maybe not doing and what was getting in the way, to really create, like you said, that opportunity to be vulnerable, that shared vulnerability, right?
Yeah. And you know, the teenagers, young teenagers will smell somebody who's insecure or being a fake or putting on a face, they'll smell that, see that so quick. You know, you have to be truly authentic if you have any chance of reaching them.
Exactly. And there's sometimes in my career where I've had to let them pull the wool over my eyes for a little bit and then approach them a little while. I'm like, I know what's going on here. I know what you're doing. And that's always a really fun conversation to them, to think that, oh, maybe they didn't, you know, have it. They couldn't pull the wool over my eyes too long, or that I was just letting them kind of just do their thing so they could just see that I'm just not that person who's just trying to get one result, but I'm going to allow them to go through their process until they can trust me.
Yeah. I love that. It's kind of like, yeah, I know I'm old and dumb and stupid and all that stuff, but you don't realize I've done everything that you're doing.
Exactly. I wrote the book on that, right?
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah. You can't get ahead of me.
Yeah, exactly.
The thing that what you just said that excited me is that if we can get this across, there's something off with me. So often we don't look at what I'm doing wrong. You know, I'm the parent, do as I say, you know, because my mom would always say, because I said so. But we don't look at, there's something off with me. Maybe I'm doing something as a parent that is, you know, that's just, I love that. If I could get everyone I meet who loves someone who's struggling with addiction, or, you know, what is off with me? What can I do, you know, to change that? I love that.
I think everybody in the family has to take that approach when they're dealing with someone with addiction, because healthy families is the collaborative thing, right? Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of vulnerability to hold up the mirror to yourself and go, oh, you know, what is my part? What needs to change?
Right.
That was a big problem that we see for people that are sending kids off to rehab or, you know, stay away. facilities and coming home and expecting things to change. I mean, at first it would be better, but because that parent had not changed the way that they connected with their loved one, it was just back old cycle, you know, which a story that I'll tell in addition to that was when I was a teenager, I lived away from home. And going through therapy, I felt very much at that time that I was the problem, right? It was made to look like that. The rest of my siblings was fine, but it was me. I was the problem. And it just felt so depressing. It felt like I was not going to come out from that, you know?
Yeah.
And then I remember a really poignant moment where the therapist said, you do realize that you are the product of what your parents have created. Mm-hmm. And it was for the first time, this weight came off me saying, oh, so it's not all me. He says it's not all you.
Yeah.
And my parents, he was honest enough with them, and they were willing enough, which was great, to say, okay, we'll go do the work now.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until they agreed to do the work and decided, like, okay, I need to change some things and admit, that we started to heal. But the healing didn't happen before that. Yeah. So we have to make it safe for parents to say, it's okay that what I'm doing may not have been the best so far for you. And that I'm going to take a look at myself, take a look at the way I was raised, come to peace with that, things that weren't right, and move and transition into the new me and figure out, like, what equation is not working for my loved one that is making us, you know, separate even further every time we talk or try and connect.
What I just heard you describe there, Holly, is the dysfunctional family role model as the scapegoat, the person that becomes a family problem to fix. And it's a lot of times for me, when I work with somebody in that's in that role, they're the most heroic one. They're the ones they're the one that's actually saying, hey, things are not right here. There's a problem here. I'm going to act out the family pain. I'm going to break this whole facade that we have around being the perfect family. I'm the one that's going to tell the truth. And but it comes at very, very costly behaviors.
Especially when the parents have manipulated the other kids to treat that one person poorly as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the whole insidiousness of that dynamic is that whatever, there's usually probably somebody else in the household that's the real problem who needs to be protected. So we'll focus on fixing this kid instead of the real pink elephant that's in the living room is the model that's out there.
And why are you pointing at me?
I raise my hand too. Sometimes those kind of situations cause people to create double lives and try to, you know, act out in ways that, you know, they're trying to explore and figure things out, but don't want to also disrupt the family dynamic, right? So, yeah, there's a lot of different ways it manifests.
Time out. I was not pointing at you.
I know.
I have no idea what this was, but it wasn't pointing at you.
So you're just making a point to the microphone.
Yeah, yeah, itself, yeah. To the world. Yeah.
I'm just being the problem child, solving it.
Oh, so you were volunteering to be a scapegoat? Okay. All right. Now that we know what that's all about, why are you pointing? Just because I'm pointing my finger doesn't mean you need to personalize it, right? Okay. Thank you all for letting us have that moment of significant other. Oh Lord, I'm not right. I'm sure. Gina and I take what we do very seriously, but God knows we don't take ourselves very seriously.
That's the way to do it.
One of the things I want to talk about, Holly, you mentioned that you're a musician and that you record music and you do that stuff. Does any of this stuff come out in your music that you write?
Yeah, you know, when I first started writing, actually, I never really admitted it to people, but it was for me personally, mm-hmm. because I felt like I didn't have a voice in the house.
Mm-hmm.
So, and what I really wanted to honestly say would put me in some deep doo-doo. I would write and kind of hide some of my messages in the songs. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways where some people are encouraged to journal, I guess that was my way of, you know, journaling. So yes. And I remember one time my mom saying, well, those are nice songs, honey, but they're pretty depressing, you know? And she was just checked out to what was really going on. And I would just be like, oh, well, you know, sometimes songs are depressing. Little did she know, I'm like, yeah, because I'm writing about stuff that, you know, I can't really talk about. So,
is there a particular, and you have your music recorded? Is it out there?
Yes, and I go under a different name. It's under Ashton Zyer, Z-Y-E-R.
Uh-huh.
And I think that my writing now has shifted. My experience has allowed me to now tell a story that maybe I hear from somebody else. So it may not be exactly my story, but I will then implant moments in there where I'm like, oh yeah, I get that. Here's this line. I've been through that one.
Yeah.
With your permission, I wouldn't mind maybe tagging a little bit of your music towards that.
Oh yeah, that would be awesome. Yeah.
So what song, if our listeners out there wanted to kind of, I don't know, get to know you as a musician and your writing and your art, what song would you recommend that maybe I tag?
Well, if it comes down to in regards to our topic, there was one specific song that I wrote, and you have to forgive me too, because a lot of the songs I'll get out of my mind so that I'm fresh for a new song.
Okay.
But the lyric said, I take your call just to hear your voice. You're telling me to hold on, that life is going to take you for a ride. So put away the bottle, baby. It doesn't make things right. And hold on, I'll get there to help you through the sleepless part of night. And that came from a friend that I had that was really struggling with addiction. He had severe sexual trauma as, you know, as a teenager. And he was calling to say, like, I don't know if I can do this. I think I'm done. I'm thinking I'm done. And I'm just like, no, you can do it. We're just going to micromanage this down to the minutes, mm-hmm. you know, and just, let's just chop it up in pieces that we can handle. But what he didn't know at that time is I had just made a big move, to follow my own music career. I didn't have a job. I was very stressed out. I was sleeping on a sofa in the studio, mm-hmm. and I was scared myself. And it was just an amazing moment to go, I'm scared. I see that you're scared. Don't worry. I was far enough along in my development to go, like, I can help you make it through, even though you don't know that I'm going through the same thing. So that song's called The Sleepless Part. If anybody's interested in that, or if you want to tag that, that's what that song's about. But there's other songs I've done when I was working with domestic violence prevention. There was a whole album that was dedicated to unhealthy relationships. And more recently, a lot of stuff that I'm doing, I'm really wanting to focus on creating the feelings of love. Mm-hmm. So I've got a few jazz pieces that I've put out.
Well, cool. It's always easier to write depression to music about depressing topics than it is about joy. So my hat's off to you. I hope you're successful. But you know, it's much easier to write, he stopped loving her today, than it is.
Have you tried writing music?
Oh yes, I've got some stuff out there that nobody wants to hear. But yes, I have written some stuff, and some around my childhood abuse. And like I said, I words are not a big deal with me. But you heard the intro music. That's all of me. That's kind of what I like to write nowadays and do that sort of stuff. And then I also kind of like to get into some real non-traditional kind of sounds based off of harmonies and stuff that's not so necessarily the three chords.
Email it over to me. I want to hear it.
No, okay. All right. Good. I'll get some stuff to you. Thank you. And what's your name? Your artist name?
Ashton Zyer, Z-Y-E-R. All right. Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Oh, what you talking about, girl?
That's good stuff, for sure. Yeah.
I just love any art. I do a lot with artists. We are creative. Those of us who have delved in, I think part of the problem for a lot of us is that we are empaths. We are creative. We are sensitive. We do feel. We do hurt. We do take on the pain of the world, you know, the whole drunken artist concept stuff. So my heart goes out to that.
What really rang true with what you had said is I write poetry, and you said that she didn't feel like she had a voice. And it never, I write poetry, fiction, nonfiction, I write whatever I can. And it just now struck me that drive, that lack of voice is the drive that did it. People ask why I write so much or why I like writing, because I need it to breathe. But what it really has given me is that voice to express those things that I can't say. You know, the metaphor that Vince does, the Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall and it fell off and broke and he can't put it back together. That's a metaphor for the pain that we're going through. But no one knows what exactly he's talking about. You know, just that, yes, because I feel that pain too. So I think that's great.
We interviewed an artist back a podcast back. Her name is Tamlin. She's here locally, mm-hmm. and she does art therapy with kids, and she's wonderful. And kids and those will express themselves through art that they will not through words, like you did when you were younger, through your music, through your words of music. You were able to express stuff that you really couldn't say. I'm glad we have conversations, because I just had one with myself.
So, in talking to you and reading up on some of the, you know, the things we wanted to talk about, you had mentioned pain management, and you're talking specifically about emotional pain management. Can you tell us about that?
I think it's kind of it was a big turning point for us in writing this book. We had written a few versions of this, and we're finding kind of success and pathways to kind of express what we were going through. But as we did our work with our clients and with ourselves, we realized that it is our ability or inability to deal with our own pain that causes the majority of these outward, more external behaviors, right? Or the disconnection that's going on in our families or just within ourselves. And so Holly has some things I know that she'll express of things that she went through, but we both kind of tapped into this idea of like, maybe we need to kind of deal with how, understand more and then deal with whatever pains that we're dealing with right now in our lives to be able to write these kind of really significant chapters in this book that we wrote. And what we found is as we processed our own traumas and our own pains, we were able to come up with concepts and skills that we were able to then use with our clients in different situations, and really hit upon these things as we shared this with the parents of clients that were struggling or whoever it might be, that they then began their own work on how they dealt with their pains and their past conditionings and their traumas and possible abuses or addictions. And it just cleared the field. It cleared the room for them to be able to see things differently. And so when we talk about pain management, it's just something that it's just those kind of family secrets or those things in our lives that we sweep under the rug or shove into a dark corner because we don't want to deal with them. But what we don't realize is that they're the ones that are pulling the strings and pulling the strings the majority of the time in our family relationships. And so it's really tough to realize that and to start cutting those cords so that then we can just be our own independent self and say that, okay, I dealt with this son or daughter. Like, this is what I'm going through. This is the pain that I've dealt with. And it just creates that opportunity for them to say, like, okay, how can I help you with what you're dealing with too? Because we're all dealing with something.
So I used to teach a strategies for success class. And I noticed I was working with these adults and they all came from an inner city environment that was impoverished. And I thought it was fascinating that some were thriving much more than others, even though they had similar neighbors, friends, whatnot.
Right.
When I did a deeper dive and asked the question, I realized that the ones that were able to thrive had mentors in their life that were positive, that were helping them deal with the everyday pains of life, difficulties of life in a way that was healing and helpful. That was my first trigger of like, well, that's really interesting. Then I went through something myself, an illness myself, where I realized that every bit of joy that I had was stripped away. I had no coping mechanisms. And Josh, I remember at the time, sent me a book by Rabbi David Wolpe. Remember the name of the book, Josh?
The dealing with the pain book. Yeah, I have it in my books. Sorry, one second. I'll get the full anyways, thing correct.
So, anyways, as I was reading that book, it said, and there was a line in there that stuck out to me, and it said that if we were to go through life in a happy state all the time, that we basically would become bored with life. We would be unhappy with it. And so, in order to be happy, to have what you really want, you have to create a space where you're going to be able to manage pain and loss. The book's called Making Loss Matter.
Yeah, that's it. I just saw it.
And so I thought, wow, you know, my whole life I've been looking at this differently. I've been thinking that loss means something bad, that I'm bad, or that I've been misfavored, or if that's the right word, that I'm not enough or have enough value. And instead I was like, no, if I want joy, I need to be at peace with pain and loss. And then I started to realize, like, well, how do I deal with that? Well, you know, over time, I've realized that fantasy was a big way of me dealing with my pain. Okay. Create these situations or scenarios in my mind of how it's going to be or could be. And I could get lost in the fantasy instead of just sitting and leaning into the discomfort. And we realized with a lot of parents that we're working with that they were becoming lesson thieves, that it was so painful for them to watch their loved one go through pain that they would rescue them. Mm-hmm. But then inevitably they'd have, you know, young adults that just weren't prepared to deal with life. And when the pain came up, instead of leaning into it and being like, oh, this is pain, I'm going to acknowledge it, it was like, oh, this is pain, this is bad for me to feel. What can I do to get out of it?
Right.
Mm-hmm. As fast as possible. And, instead of conditioning, when you can condition a child at a young age to go like, oh, wow, that was uncomfortable. How that feel? Talk them through it. Make them feel okay with it. Talk about coping mechanisms that are healthy, not buying stuff and having QVC boxes stacked up at the front door, you know,
yeah.
or overeating or, you know, or drug addiction or whatever, you know, then as the trials and the things in life got more difficult, they felt, you know, more confident and strong enough to get through that because they had had a history of being helped through it. So we talk about that a lot, that parents need to look at the way that they self-soothe, mm-hmm. and actually ask, is it healthy? Does it need to shift? And how is my loved one seeing the way that I self-soothe and feeling like it's okay to self-soothe the way that they do? Because a lot of times the parents that will point and go, you're doing this, you know, and it's bad. And not saying like, well, yeah, they might be addicted to this, but look at those boxes. Like I said, you keep purchasing, you know, they just can't find the relation between the two. So we ask to start with yourselves. How do you manage pain? Did your parents teach you a healthy way? How many times do you try and rescue your loved one from their pain? Do they have great tools to deal with their pain? Have you talked about that as a family? What's healthy? What's not, you know, what's not healthy, and created a plan. Right? So that they can develop in a way that makes them more efficacious, more resilient in their lives.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I'm having like this massive, profound moment. I lost my son to suicide four years ago now. And as soon as I lost him, you know, I was drinking before, but the drinking got worse and worse and worse. And then I added sleeping pills and I went that way for about 7 months. And it wasn't till I stopped and really looked at what I learned from his death, which is that's when I realized I wasn't fully loving until I lost the thing I fully loved, if that makes any sense. And it kind of, you know, the way you're explaining this is that loss gave me the opportunity to look. I saw this huge connection as you were talking about it. I don't know that it's coming out right, but it feels like it's very similar to what you were saying is, you know, you have to see the bad in order to understand what the good is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and create a space for it, and that it's okay. It's normal. You know, we need to, as a culture and community, not feel shame around loss.
You know, Holly, what I really related to in your sharing is, if I have pain, that must mean I am broken, because healed people don't have pain. And that's just that insane, you know, if I'm in pain, I am broken. No, that just means something's off center. Something's not right. You need to take a look at something. You need to adjust something. And then the other thing I thought about was my father. My father used to bang the table and say, don't do as I do as I say do. Well, all I did is he did. I never did what he said to do. I did the behavior that he modeled. So yeah.
There's some statistics right now. I mean, a lot of the clients that I'm working with and are what they would, I don't really like this term, but they call them failure to launches, right? Like I get these calls from parents whose kids can't make it through freshman year of college or come back and, you know, they give up. And it really is their inability to deal with the tension of life and the pain of life and their discomfort. And like Holly said, I think it's really important that, the enabling and the lesson thieving that's been going on with this culture that parents have been kind of in for the last maybe couple of decades has produced these trends now where 30% of freshmen are coming home their first year in college. And that's a huge number of kids who then come home, feel that failure, feel that kind of loss of like, what happened? What did I do wrong? And then they don't know what to do with it. And then that's when they find either an unhealthy coping mechanism, or they come to us to try to figure out how to work through that so that they can be resilient and strong and be able to work through what are the ups and downs of adult life, right?
Yeah. I have got several men that I work with in the area of their codependency on their fathers of addicts that the crisis, family crisis that they seek help in was this freshman failure to launch. Is he just mm-hmm. Because it might have been involved drinking and drugging and all that sort of stuff. And then, wow, you know, they spent all these thousands of dollars for college and the guy flunked out within the first 3 weeks. One of my guys that I work with comes to find out his kid did not attend class past the first class.
Yeah. You know? I've had that happen. Yeah.
So that failure to launch, I like that. I haven't heard that way, but it's that crisis sometimes that can bring about the help. Yeah. Once again, I had another conversation with myself, but it felt
it's important to understand that when something is showing up, and I think that's what Holly was saying so beautifully, is that when something is showing up, it is not a negative. And so when these parents call us and they're like, hey, this is what's going on with my kid, we try to paint it as an opportunity. Like, let's dig in, sit down, sit in the mud together, figure out what's going on, and figure out a path forward versus it just being like, shame on me, I'm the worst parent. And we get that. We get in that victim or that martyr mode very, very easily. But that's just another way of dealing with pain that's not as healthy, right? And so, yeah, in the process of writing this book and that chapter, we really, like Holly said, fantasy is something that I do as well, where it's just like, I don't want to deal with reality, so I'm going to future trip and I'm going to get in the future. I'm going to create this really wonderful picture for myself and then ignore what's going on presently. And that just adds up and adds up until something pops, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep. And in the meantime, we get a lot of great science fiction novels and stuff.
That's true.
So, once again, I'm back to the artist, right?
No, it's good though.
Creating.
There's a lot of meaning in those sci-fi novels, for sure.
Absolutely.
At least the artist is creating. The person that's consuming in fantasy is just getting lost, you know?
Well, you know, I haven't thought about this in years, Holly, but when you were talking about, as a kid, I was fussed at in grammar school for sitting daydreaming. I was a big daydreamer, daydreaming, but no, it was flights of fantasy to escape the pain of my upbringing, you know? Yeah. I realize that now. God, I wish I could go back and give that guy a hug and say, you know, you're doing the best you can. This is a normal reaction to a real abnormal event you got going on here. You know, daydream your ass off, but if every now and then you do a little homework, that'd be good too. But
I think they'll find too later on as more science develops and there's more research that things like ADD, ADHD, things like that are that inability to focus maybe and to daydream is really a kid unable to process some tension that they have in their life that is unresolved. And that is it's an important thing to acknowledge is that these kids are sitting in their classrooms or sitting at their kitchen tables trying to focus, but they can't because they're dealing with something that they don't know how to process.
You know, Josh, golly, just triggering so much. This is so good for me. This is like a therapy session in some ways, but I realized that I was so anxious. I had to be so hypervigilant because I never knew when the rage of my upbringing was going to come, that I could not really concentrate on my homework. I could not dive into that because I had to be constantly hypervigilant about when the next uproar was going to come, when the next beating was going to come, all that stuff. Who in the hell cares about 3 + 3 = 6 if you don't know when the next beating's going to come?
Yeah.
And what caused it and what you can do. And then you got another person who's telling you it's your fault. If you just behaved better, your daddy wouldn't need to do all this and all that kind of bull caca that goes on. I don't want to say bullshit, so I'll say bull caca. So I'm just kind of relating to exactly what you talked about. I was ADD as a child, but I was full of anxiety and had to be hypervigilant. That's not really ADD. That's being full of anxiety and hypervigilant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're good, Holly.
And then the autonomic system is then affected and you're needing relief, right? Mm-hmm. So chemical relief is the most natural thing that you want to go for when you realize that things in the body are happening in succession.
And also, as a kid, as a 10-year-old, I didn't have access to drugs or alcohol or whatever, but I did have access to what? Fantasy, you know what I mean? You know, and we use the tools that we have available to deal with it, yeah?
Yeah, because it would stimulate the brain for the chemicals that you needed
mm-hmm.
in order to calm the autonomic system, right?
Mm-hmm. What is the autonomic system? What is that? So
it's the nervous system that affects everything, the way that the frequencies run through the body, right? And a lot of they're realizing now that a lot of kids that are struggling with anxiety have a dysregulated autonomic system, and from stress, from trauma that they haven't been able to process.
Mm-hmm.
And so early childhood trauma like you're going through creates not only that problem, but it also can create a split in personality. So you can feel one way and you can feel exactly the opposite, be confused about that, yeah. Of how you're living in two different worlds, because the brain is trying to survive, right? And it's so yeah, personality splits are very common for trauma.
And those who have been sexually abused as a child, there's this real sexual spiritual split that goes on too, where they split off. They can either be super religious, super heroic, or they can be super bad. You know, we see that worked out in so many of the religious leader stuff. We see that in doctors and other stuff. I'm not here to talk bad about religious leaders, but we see that kind of sexual spiritual split off manifest itself in our society with pastors and priests and all these people because of this childhood trauma that you're talking about, this pain, the disassociation that we have to do to deal with that. You know,
yep, exactly.
To break those parts off. It's so insidious.
And that's our main invitation, I think, is it's just so important to invite people to deal with what they're dealing with, to not repeat cycles, right? And that's basically what's happening over and over again, whether it's physical abuse, sexual abuse, a lot of this stuff is just repeating past pains and trying to deal with it. The brain is looking for homeostasis, and sometimes the homeostasis that's created in the brain is really, really unhealthy. And so the brain doesn't like it when we're out of homeostasis, when we're looking for, when we're trying to solve something or we're trying to deal with it, it's very, very uncomfortable. And the brain doesn't like that. That sometimes it's almost like we double down on our addictions and our pain sometimes. But if we can really just accept the invitation to work on this pain, it frees up. It creates new paths instead of just the repetition of past patterns and past abuses, right?
I'm going to ask the same question to both of you. What is your main tool that you use to deal with your pain, your personal pain? Because we all have pain. Pain's part of the human condition.
Well, I think Josh and I talked about that both of ours has been the same in different ways. Fantasy seeking. And I come from a family of eaters.
Yeah.
You know, I like that bowl of ice cream now. I deserve this. It's been a long day. I'm going to eat. Right.
There's nothing better than refined carbohydrates to fix the feeling.
That's right.
But what do you do today? What do you do? What do you do that's a little bit more healthier than maybe those choices?
Now that we've gone through it. Right. Okay. Yeah. Josh, did you want to start on that?
Yeah, I can start. It's up to, I found meditation to be a lifeline for myself. I've been to different retreats and things, and I think my kind of controlling mind sometimes turned meditation into just a problem solving tool where I'd sit down on the pillow and whatever I was feeling, I would just try to solve. And I realized how unhealthy that was from a teacher, where now my meditation is really learning to sit in tension and seeing what that feels like, where I'm feeling it in my body, what memories are associated with it, and just feeling the tension so that I can understand and teach my brain that it is real. And this is something that I want to deal with, and I want to understand it and bring it into my self-awareness. So when I go about my day, when I'm off my meditation pillow, I can then say, oh, yeah, that's how it's showing up, or that just caused me to do this, or I held back because of this way. But just to really get to know the tension of it has been a lifeline for me, instead of just trying to solve, which my brain tends to do, is just like, oh, that's easy, I'll solve it. But it's not real, because my brain just wants that homeostasis, it just wants it done. Yeah. But I just need to learn to sit with it.
So what I heard you say is, You start with dealing with painful feelings by feeling them.
Mm-hmm.
Feelings are feeling. If her feelings,
yep.
Oh, okay, good deal. And I really relate to that. Holly.
Yeah, I think that was the major shift when I read the book, Making Loss Matter, and came to that kind of realization in my mind. I wasn't taking time to acknowledge when loss and pain was coming. Mm-hmm. I was just quickly like, moving through my life and or finding a reward of some sort. So now I'm just more self-aware. So when it comes up, I'll go, ew. You know, I don't like this feeling. Okay. But I have hope and an understanding now, knowing it's not going to be forever. So I'm going to lean into it. It might be here for the day. I'm going to balance my scales a bit. So I'm going to celebrate something today that happened that was out of the ordinary for me. You know what I mean? Like, so if I feel gross, I might be at the grocery store and find chicken on sale. And I'll be like, it's the most awesome day today. Chicken's on sale.
Yeah, yeah. You know?
So I've been teaching my brain to accentuate the everyday things that are a little bit miraculous, where, you know, things show up as a gift. And that helps me not get locked into like, woe is me, bad day, bad things going on. Right. Mm-hmm. So that I'm able to kind of endure the things that are hard that day or that week. That's a different technique that I'm using now than I have before.
It's really nice to know that I'm not weird for getting overly excited about stickers. I do the same thing. I'm easy to please. Yeah, the stickers made my day.
Yeah, and stickers aren't going to hurt anybody. Something that you enjoy, right? We always just talk about, like, just make sure what we enjoy doesn't become too crazy, right?
Right.
The person that likes to use the video game is not in it for hours, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that we're just, but yeah, those little things. If somebody calls you up on the phone that you didn't expect, that was thinking about you, mm-hmm. that we live in that space of gratitude, like, wow, that's amazing today. You thought about me and I didn't even think about you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But thank you.
So what I heard you say was the same thing that Josh said, that you feel your feelings. But the other thing that I heard you say is that you bring yourself right back to right here, right now. Right, kind of right where your feet are. Let's enjoy buying chicken, whatever. That I've also related to that's very important, kind of like a regrounding, feel where my feet are. So that's another good thing. Gina, what do you do? I love it. I got caught by surprise.
You did. What do I do? You got me very caught by surprise.
Now, what do you do with painful feelings?
What do I do with pain? Oh, you know, a lot of really what Josh said is to get in the meditation, to get in the here and now. But the other thing I'd like to do is to think about where they originally came from. You know, if something you say makes me angry, it's probably not what you said, but it's probably something that happened in my past. And when I can remind myself that this is what happened today is not where my true anger is, then I can detach from the anger. I don't know if that makes sense, but I just know that everything that I'm triggered by, like the loud noises. I was thinking about that last night. I don't like loud noises. They bother me. I get so angry when I hear them. And I was born in Washington, D.C. in 1968, where bombs were going off around me. And it struck me last night that maybe that's why I'm having the problem with the loud noises. It's not you. It's not you. It's, you know, bombs.
Gina's significant other likes to scare her, what she's talking about with love. And I've been trying to have a talk with that son of a bitch to get him to stop it, but he won't. Speaking,
I thought we were talking about the snoring as sounding like bombs going off.
No. Loud noises.
Okay. Yeah. And Josh, ask Vince what he does.
Vince, what do you do?
Oh, great question. I'm glad you asked that, Josh. You know, what I do is I take my pain and connect with people. I'm kind of that person. Some people like to isolate, and that's fine. I call people and say, this is what's going on. And then sometimes if it's real deep and real fantasy producing or disassociation, well, I'll actually go to a therapist with it sometimes. I'll go get professional help and say, hey, this crap's coming out of the wolves are banging on the door, and I don't know why, you know, so... But I take that connection that we talked about earlier with my pain. I got some people that'll hear my pain without fixing it. They'll just sit there and go, wow. Just
how do you psych yourself up to be that vulnerable with somebody? I mean, I know that maybe you've built that relationship with them over time, but it's not easy to pick up the phone and say, I need help.
Yeah. It came out of the desperation of 28 years ago of completely destroying my life through my drug addiction, my sex addiction, all my addictions I did. My life was destroyed, and I had no choice but either make connection or die or kill myself. Mm-hmm. So it was out of that desperation that I was forced to do some trusting. But then since that time, it's consistency over time. I've got some people that know everything that there is to know about me, and I trust them, and I know everything that is to know about them. But it takes time, you know, and I've trusted some wrong people in the past, and they did violate those confidences. But the answer to your question is, I got into a position where I had no choice but either kill myself or do something different.
Vince says you've got to be incredibly vulnerable. And it's one of the things that I think so many people in our community love about him is that vulnerability. Not just like I can be vulnerable with what I've said in my past, but emotionally I'm not incredibly vulnerable, but he's emotionally vulnerable, which is wonderful.
No, it's all right. She calls it vulnerable. I just call it being authentic, but it's good.
I think that takes, what I loved hearing you say was the time that it takes for something like that to be built. I think in our culture nowadays, and something that Holly and I see a lot is just this instant gratification, this culture that if it doesn't happen after one conversation, like, oh, well, I just tried that with my son or my daughter and it didn't work. So it's not going to work anymore, but it takes time and effort and rejection and not personalizing. And like we talked about earlier, for this to work, for this connection to work, and for that vulnerability to be established. And I love what you said. I just wanted to kind of add that on top of it.
Yeah. Don't think I'm not going to do something like that till I have no avenue left, Josh, you know. And one of the things about this insidiousness of the drug addiction that I'm seeing in the 12-step rooms that I attend, the nature of what we're going through with the crystal meth and the crack and just how brittle all of that stuff is, and the fentanyl and the scariness that's out there, is that people are getting to that. I was 40 years old when I got into that desperate state. A lot of them are getting into that desperate state earlier and earlier, which can be a good thing or a bad thing. My life would have gone a lot better if I'd been that desperate at 20 instead of 40. But that I really had no choice. When I say it was either kill myself or do something different, that really was my two choices. Why'd you hit me?
So I wanted to find out about the book.
Oh, okay.
We're running low on time. We've hit an hour.
Oh, nice.
And if I don't hit him once in a while, he can talk forever.
Yeah, here's the book right here. I have it. So we did joke about the fact that it was this idea of banging your head against the wall. So
right.
The parents we worked with, we just felt like they weren't making any headway. They didn't feel like they had ownership in the equation. They didn't feel like they had the right tools. And we've been there because we worked with the teens. And where we're coming from is a space of saying, we're making headway. Let us show you how. And these are the things that we've learned that we think you can learn. And we think that there's a lot more runway in your home than in treatment centers. That was, you know, that they need this connection at home. So you asked about the amount of books. We originally wrote it to be quite long. And then we had one of our friends say, like, I got to be honest with you, I'm not going to have time to read that book.
Right.
So we decided to like break it down into segments. The first book is about the love, the caretaker. That can be a grandparent, that could be an uncle, parents in the equation, how they're showing up in the lives of those that they love and what they can do to help them and change. And as they're working with their loved one that's dealing with addiction or at-risk behaviors, it's a variety of things. And then the second book is called Cracking the Communication Code. And that's where we really are going to dissect about the way that we talk to each other, the words that we use, how we position our conversations that turn people away or bring us closer together. And then the third book is going to be about creating a culture of connection, the traditions and the things that we have in our homes that bring us together and or push us away. And we look a lot at different examples, family culture examples, and what's working and what's not working in that third book. Josh, you want to add anything?
It's just a labor of love, I think, is the best way to describe it. I think the genesis of it really was, you know, Holly and I met for lunch and we were frustrated because the question that we got from parents all the time is like, how do you do this? Like, what are you doing? How do you connect with my kid and I can't? And we really just had to sit for a long time and break it down and say, okay, well, these are the things that we feel like we do. And then we got to test those assumptions, go out there and see if they were really what we thought they were. And we've tried to really distill that down into something that's very digestible. That's something that people can read the book and take away a lot of different skills and ideas to kind of go out and work with, instead of it just being 10,000 foot view of everything. And so we really want parents to and caretakers to apply these things, at least in the first book, to help them to focus on themselves and kind of clear the room, clear the air, so then we can teach them these other things that we also feel like Holly just mentioned are the most important things of learning how to communicate and creating that connection culture at home. So,
isn't it wonderful to have a passion, to have some idea that we know some things that might can help, help people do something different, and then have a passion and the desire to do that? I really relate to what y'all are doing, and there's plenty of people out there that need this kind of help. There's plenty that people can take advantage of what you have to offer. That is awesome.
Yeah. Where can we get your book?
Currently on Amazon right now. Banghead Here. You can get it on Kindle, and also there's an audiobook version on Audible.
I just got excited.
Yeah. So, and there's lots of, I know that Vince had mentioned he loves stories. There's lots of stories, and we've kind of, you know, made it so that they're a little bit anonymized and things like that. But there's a lot of stories in there that we hope will allow people to see that they're not alone in this, right? That this is something that they can relate to. It's just not us spouting off. Right. It's hard won advice. Holly and I have had to deal with a lot of clients. We've lost clients. There's a lot of real world experience built into these books.
Right. I got excited about the Audible because there's a couple books that I will just listen to chapter and just, I mean, like I really enjoy, I can read a book, but the Audible just allows me to redo the chapters over and over again. And I love that. I'm so excited. So I'll be looking for it there. And I got credit. So I get
Cool. Perfect.
I'm so excited. What did I say about the stickers and my excitement? You just made my day.
Yeah, you got it. Awesome. We were thinking about you.
Yeah. And we got a nice, soothing male Canadian voice to read it. He's been great for us. I've gotten a lot of comments on that too. Like, the voice is very soothing. We really, really like it. It's very, you know, so it's been great. So I think the audiobook is very nice as well.
Good. I'm so excited.
That's good. And Ashton, where can we find your music?
Oh, on all streaming platforms, Spotify, iTunes. Though I'm going to put a plug in for Apple iTunes because they pay the artist appropriately. Spotify is not
good.
But if you want to find it, you can find it there.
Apple iTunes is where we're going to go because us artists that are starving, we like, you know, by our refined carbohydrates, and we need
also ice cream.
Ice cream is shooting up in price.
Hey,
do not depress me today, Josh.
Yeah. No, I mean I'm a travel addict, and so with gas prices the way that they are and things like that, I've been kind of having to stay home a little bit. So it's just
It's pretty sad when you look at your partner and go, baby, we can't afford to go to the grocery store. No, I mean, seriously, we just can't get there.
Yeah.
We can afford the groceries. We just can't afford to get there. Yeah,
exactly.
The positive would be maybe if we ride our bikes, we can get everything we want to eat that we shouldn't eat because we'll burn it off on the way home.
There you go. I like that.
The silver lining right there. Yeah.
Whoop, there goes that fantasy again, Holly. But,
I don't even remember if I own a bike. I think I do. Yeah,
that would be the first step. You want to go bike riding? Yeah, but let's go to the bike store. All right, good. Do we have? I, you know, on our side, call to action. I know people are probably watching out there in YouTube land. This Back Porch Chats cup. Isn't it a nice cup? Look at that.
Nice. I noticed that at the beginning. I was like, look at you.
Yeah, I know people want them. It makes the coffee taste better, but t-shirts and all kinds of stuff out there at nowsoberlife.com. So you can do that or be a patron and support this. And we'll put in the links for y'all's coaching services and stuff. I know Perfect. That there's we've got people that'll want to connect up and take advantage of, because y'all are wonderful. I mean, y'all really are open, vulnerable, authentic.
Vince, you have a shirt that has your face on it with your headphones, because that would be legit.
You can make that happen.
I like sparking it. Ideas.
Yeah. I like how
I like it. I would like a shirt like that.
Okay. All right, we'll do it, and I'm going to send you one.
Nice.
All right. Okay.
Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. We end of another podcast.
A lot of fun. My stomach hurts.
Yes. This, you know, hurt. I love what we do, connecting with these people and meeting people and making these friendships and helping each other out and helping the world be a little better place. Mm-hmm. Holly, Josh, already fell in love with both of you. Yes,
thanks for being here.
You got it.
Thanks for having us.
My face literally does hurt. Your cheeks.
Welcome to Back Porch Chats,
where we have conversations about hope, grace, and recovery.
Our mission is to shape 12-step communities where sponsors and sponsees support each other to move beyond the shame of abuse.
We are dedicated to sharing knowledge about the connection between addiction and sexual abuse with people who are struggling to stop their destructive compulsive behavior.
Are you ready to embrace freedom from your past trauma
and help others do the same? If so, grab a cup of coffee
and join the conversation on the Back Porch with Vince
and Gina.
All right, Gina, here we are, another podcast.
Mm-hmm. I'm very excited today.
Oh, yes, very good. I've already been able to make connections with these people, and I have a fellow musician who was probably impressed with our opening music because the musician did all of it that's sitting right here in this chair. Mm-hmm. Everything that was there was me.